Blog Talk Radio.
Quiet, please. Welcome to Rex Sykes Movie Beat, conversations with filmmakers where we discuss everything film and television. Here on Movie Beat, you'll learn what to do and what not to do when it comes to making movies and TV, and we will talk to everyone behind the scenes and in front of the camera, and they'll provide you with the guests and the information you're going to want to have, whether you're a filmmaker or a fan. And so now let's move behind the scenes here at Movie Beat. My guest today is Mr. Todd Robinson. He's the director of the recent release Phantom that he's written and produced along with Penn Denship and Julian Adams and others. And it was out in theaters. I saw it. I loved it. This is his second time on the show, and we're going to continue our discussion. So he's going to come up in just a few moments. We'll let you know more about him in just a couple seconds. The chat room is open, so if you're listening live, you can join us in the chat room. That is always available when you listen live. And all of these interviews are archived at RexSykes.com. That's the official URL for Rex Sykes Movie Beat. I'm your host. Rex Sykes is RexSykes.com. That's my name. And all of these interviews can be listened to live right from RexSykes.com at the interviews blog. You find my guest. You go through their biography, and you find the link that says to listen, and you click on that link. If it has the date and says it's upcoming, it's a live interview. If it doesn't have a date, it just says to listen, click the link. It's an archived interview. And all of these interviews, over 300 interviews, 350 interviews, 400 hours, something like that, are all archived right there at RexSykes.com. You can also listen right from Blog Talk Radio, or you can get the podcast from the iTunes Store. It's absolutely free. What we ask in return, in exchange for all the information that we're providing, because Movie Beat's really designed to be a resource for you, and that's why I'm connecting you up with all sorts of professionals who are in the trenches, making it happen, giving away secrets and tips and suggestions and what to do and what not to do. All we ask in return is two things. One, share the interviews far and near with all of your contacts, your connections, your friends, your filmmakers, anyone, fans, and share it. Post it, tweet it, Facebook it, Google Plus it, use your favorite social media means, email, phone, in person. Share these interviews with others so that they too can benefit from the expertise and the experience and the information my guests are sharing. And number two, please leave comments at the player, at the Blog Talk Radio player. Leave comments before you leave. If you're in the chat room, don't leave the chat room without leaving a comment at the player. You can also rate and review the podcast at the iTunes Store. When you do that, it increases our visibility on the internet, and we really appreciate it. It helps other people find the important information contained in each of these discussions. All right. Without any further ado, I'm going to bring on Todd. How are you today, Todd?
Good morning, Rex. Good to be with you again.
Good to be with you again, too. And I want to tell listeners that you have. We recently did a show together not that long ago, and they can find that and listen to that in their leisure. But you directed a movie that I very much liked, starring Ed Harris and David Duchovny and William Fichtner and Jonathan Shake, and among others, The Phantom, or I should say Phantom. And they can find, listeners can also find information about the movie at solarfilmworks.com, the SolarFilmWorks.com. So we've got your website out there as well, and the Filmworks website out there.
Great.
So anything that you want to catch us up with? Or
Just living La Vida Loca, you know. You know, coming off of a couple of weeks of pretty heavy press here in L.A. and in New York, and good to be home and sort of rebooting, you know, getting ready for the next one.
Well, that's very cool. And you do have a next one that you're up preparing, as I understand it.
I do. It's a passion project I've been working on for 13 years. I was reminded by Julian yesterday. It's a project called The Last Full Measure, and I have a wonderful cast set up and ready to go. And it's a story about a Medal of Honor that was actually overlooked back in 1966, and it's a story about in the present about how a group of veterans who served with this pararescueman, he was a combat medic, regrouped around the internet, sort of reunited around the internet, rediscovered each other, and the fact that this man had been overlooked by the Defense Department, and enlist the help of a young, arrogant political mover shaker who works inside the Department of the Air Force. And it's really a story about how that man goes from a man of complete self-interest to a man of sacrifice. And it's kind of interesting the way as he investigates this story that he's very reluctant to do, he sort of, in a way, becomes the very man that he's investigating. And so it's very heartfelt. It has a lot of action in it because it's about a very bloody battle that took place in Zaikemai in 1966. But it's something I really want to get done, mostly for the veterans who it's about, who I've become friends with over the years. And you meet these men and you realize why it's so important for them to have their story told. And that's one of the privileges of being a filmmaker, is that you get to, from time to time, step into worlds that ordinary mere mortals don't, you know, get to do or see. And in this case, it's been just a tremendous privilege to hear their stories and bear witness to their emotions.
Wow, that is really, truly, truly cool, and you're so right. I mean, filmmakers and behind the scenes and those in front of or on camera in front of the camera do often get to live either vicariously or actually try on you know, many different aspects of other real life things that most of us you know would never ever get to do. It's a fascinating place to be able to fascinating career to be able to do that. Well, since we're talking about this, you know, one of the things that maybe you can guide us or walk us through is the, you know, what you would call the genesis of a project, you know, to go through production from, you know, the soup to nuts, from, you know, you have an idea and where you take it.
Sure. Well, it's, you know, the coin of the realm is the realm of ideas, and the idea is the thing, and sometimes they come from inside and sometimes they come from outside. And when they do come from the outside, it's often a process of not just taking a story. I mean, most stories seem to me to not be organized in a way that a movie is, which is why when people fall in love with books and then they see the adaptation on the screen, they're often disappointed for a variety of reasons, but maybe the foremost is that they don't really, you know, a novel doesn't fit the same kind of three-act structure that we're so accustomed to in commercial movies. So the first thing that happens is I'll hear a story or be told a story or pitch the story, read an article, and there'll be something in it that touches me. I mean, there are many, many things that I read that I just, you know, I think that's interesting, and it doesn't push the button, but occasionally it does, and when it does, it's usually something that isn't immediate, but something that sticks with me, and then a process of discovery has to happen where you, as the storyteller, have to figure out how you figure into this process and into the story. In other words, what is it in this piece of material or in this character's story that whereby you can explore a little piece of yourself too? And so for me, that's usually the very, very beginning of the thing, and usually I can't shake it. And so you think about it, you process it, and maybe you get to a point where you you know, begin the actual building blocks of adapting it as a screenplay.
Wow. Can I want to ask a question, a side question. As a young person, you know, I said, oh, I got this great story idea. And I said, here's my idea. And they said, yeah, that's an idea, but there's no story there. And I was kind of like, well, yeah, but I mean, you know, you write the story. But there's, you know, there's a difference between an idea and a story. Do you differentiate as such, or do you in the question that I'm asking? I imagine a lot of people go, I got an idea for a movie, but
I see what you're saying. Everybody seems to have an idea for a movie. But unless
the movie may not be there.
Unless you understand the craft of how to adapt that idea into something that is filmable, whereby characters travel through that landscape, growing, coming in conflict with things, obstacles, and so forth. Unless you understand that, it's simply, you know, a fragment of something. And that's really the work of it. If you're really passionate about it, you have to figure out a way to make it a viable piece of material for cinema. And, I mean, not all books lend themselves to the cinema. I mean, if something's, like, totally internal, I mean, how do you, you know, you want to hear the book read to you? Is it going to be, you know, voiceover from beginning to end? You know, it becomes more of a tone poem, maybe. I guess I'm not exactly sure what your question was, except to differentiate between the two. And I can only speak to my own, you know, process, and I've, you know, certainly had people shake me off more than a few times in my career. But I think you have to do that homework, and you have to understand basic structure so that when you go in to tell that story or pitch that story, that you're telling it in a form that the buyer or the person on the other side of the room can experience in the form of a movie. And that's
you very much answered my question. I mean, in other words, you know, I've got an idea that, you know, somebody's going to do something and you know, or that there's some form of corruption in the government or whatever, until it's put into a story structure, it does exist as an idea. I mean, in other words.
Well, yeah, you know, you're leading me to a different answer, which is generally it's not what a story is about, it's who the story is about. So if you have a story that's interesting about, oh, I don't know, you know, you just said it, a piece of government corruption or a cover-up or something, I want to know who it's about. Is it about the man investigating it? Is it about, I mean, how are we going to experience that story? And how does that story change the person who's investigating it? Is it somebody who's naive who comes in, who's a true blue believer in whatever the institution is, and their eyes are opened, and yet they hold on to their optimism? I mean, what is your take on it? That's, you know, you hear that a lot. That's like some of that Hollywood, you know, jargon. You know, what's your take? Well, that's an example of a take. You know, how do you want to take me through the story so that I experience it in a way that is meaningful to you, and hopefully it's broad and open enough so that I may project my own life experience into it, so that I can claim the movie for my own, you know, so that there's something in it for me too, which is an interesting thing in making films. If you're, you know, it's one of the classic example is, you know, if Clint Eastwood going through his scripts with a Sharpie and, you know, etching out, you know, half of the lines. But he understood something very early, I think. I can't speak for him, but I think this is what that anecdote means, is that he understood that he, like the movie screen, is a blank canvas that the audience interactively projects their own feelings on. And if you talk too much, if you say too much, in a screenplay as well, you sort of rob them of that exploratory experience and of the ability to unconsciously experience it through their own prism. And so when one is writing a screenplay, I think it serves the entire process to not overwrite. That just kind of popped up when you were talking about that, because we do tend to overdo it and over-explain. And sometimes in Hollywood movies, you know, people go into, they have test screenings and so forth, and there is confusion occasionally, or often, really, especially with first cuts when they're tested. And unfortunately, people that don't understand process, that don't understand that it's probably as much dissolution is as much in paring down as it is in building up, will, add dialogue, or add things. And that's why we sometimes feel like movies are a little dumbed down when they're over-explained. So it's a very fine thing to make these things really sing properly.
Well, I think that that's an excellent answer, excellent point of discussion too, that you just gave, and the notion that movies, really stories, are probably, we think in terms of what, but it really is about who the characters are, who we can identify with, who we love, who we hate, who we want to, yes, the what is important, but it's what happens to who or whom that makes a story.
Conversely, it's the reason why movies don't get made without actors. They don't get financed without actors, because it's the movie star and whatever they mean in the greater lexicon of popular culture. They're bringing that thing to the fore, and that's why things tend to get financed. Some movies, smaller movies and so forth, get financed without that, but in the world that I travel in, it's all about that actor and what they're and the fact that we're going to track the story through them, and that's the thing that's quantifiable. That's the thing that they can look to and put a price on, or a possible price on, in terms of how the movie might perform, which is utter nonsense in a way, because if you can put the best actor in the world in a bad movie, and it's still going to be a bad movie. But
true.
Anyway.
Well, but it makes it almost. We could find every counterexample in the world, and every generalization, and everybody would have an opinion. But if I were going to venture a thought regarding this, just in terms of human psychology, it appears that we grow up playing, whether we were cowboys or Indians or banks and robbers or doctor and nurse or whatever it might have been. While we do that, we often play, or at least in my experience, somebody. We were Errol Flynn, or we are, Christopher Reeve, or whoever we see as the cowboy, the good or the bad one, or the good or bad banker. We emulate others. We have idols. We have sports heroes. We have all these. So it makes a whole lot of sense that we want to see, a particular actor or star respond to a situation and or go through it, because we tend to vicariously do that when we're sitting in the screen. We, not only do we want to make love to the men and women, but we want to be them. We get to live for 2 hours through them.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent point that you make, especially if you dial it back to when you were a kid going to the movies, because that's kind of the golden age for each of us. Our favorite movies, often are of that time. And I think a number of things are going on. I remember when my mom would, take me and my sister or our friends to the movies and pick us up afterwards, and driving home in the car, we would be like, I can remember this, and then the guy said, yeah, 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 and then so-and-so said, and like we'd replay the whole movie. We'd remember lines and things, and there was a reason for that, and I think it has to do with that these are all sort of morality plays, and on one
sure.
level or another. And so that's how, popular culture, at least in those days, served us to sort of, work out, and consider the social mores of the time or whatever, conflict resolution, in a Western, a man's got to do what a man's got to do. It's the code of the West. Codes are big. That's another
sure.
thing. I was talking to a student the other night about a script, and I happened to remember, he was like, well, what do you mean by a code? And one of the best examples that just popped into my head was Harrison Ford in The Fugitive, where he's in a hospital. He's a doctor, so he's already got a code, right? It's called the Hippocratic Oath.
Uh-huh.
And so we know that this man, above all else, is about saving lives. And to make that point, the filmmakers, a young boy is wheeled in, has been in a car accident or something, and he's having trouble breathing. And the doctor, Harrison Ford, risks his freedom to save this kid. And from that moment on in the movie, you're with him.
Right.
Because
right,
that's
right.
Who he is. And so now I have a vested interest in this innocent man who is about other people to resolve the conflict that he has. And so, I'd watch that guy in 5 movies. So that's what we're trying to find.
Sure.
And I'm not just talking about a little theatrical trick. I'm
right,
using
right.
to illustrate a point that it's who, not what.
Well, I go back to a couple of things, and I loved what you just said, and it is the who. You know, when I was a child, I liked Groucho Marx movies. They were funny, but I didn't like them just because they were funny, but I liked Groucho Marx. You know, I happened to like Harpo Marx. I was a huge fan of Steve Reeves' Hercules. Jack Mahoney didn't impress me as Hercules, or Gordon Scott. Well, he was okay, you know.
Yeah,
but,
right.
But I went out and played Hercules. I was thinking of Steve Reeves or Morgan the Pirate or whatever. I very much strongly identified with the actor and or what the actor faced. And I think that what you just said about the Harrison Ford character, the notion that I love things that are very nuanced and subtle and you know, they have all these intricacies and. But maybe when it really truly boils down to it, we are just so much readier served as a culture with just hot and cold and black and white and, you know, up and down, that the kind of extreme things, it's the good and the bad, the white hat and the black hat, those themes that you can nuance them all you want, but you know, when Harrison Ford did what he did and he stood up, there's this kind of moral or ethical kind of behavior in him. I think that there is something in us that champions that. Maybe it's if we're older, or I don't know if it's true if that's younger today or what, but
Well, I think I think black hats and white hats do serve a certain purpose, because most people, unless you're passive aggressive or psychotic or something, you pretty much always know what the right thing to do is.
Right,
you
right.
know when you're serving yourself, and you know when you're serving something, bigger than you. We know these things.
Right.
And so we are reminded of them thematically through popular culture, through books, through movies, through television, through, however our stories are being related back to us. And they're really reflections of us. And they're reminding us. I mean, it's the whole thing about the hero's journey. I mean, you know, Campbell talks about this. Why do the same stories appear in parallel in just vastly different cultures simultaneously?
Mm.
And it's because we're constantly exploring and rethinking our role in sort of a broader world, a greater world. Now, when we get older, these things become clouded with confusion, with conflict, with what's the word I'm looking for? Just the complexity of day-to-day life, where it's not black and white anymore. It's rather gray, because there are 6 things that you're trying to manage at the same time, and one of the balls is going to fall. And the ball usually takes the form of a person. You know, how do you pay? I've got the boss has told me that I have to stay late tonight, but my kids depending on me to be at a soccer game, and after the soccer game, I'm in charge of getting dinner, and you know, whatever it is, and something falls. You're going to disappoint somebody, so what is the right thing to do? And so, you know, when we're doing the scene work and those, you know, when you're writing scene work and directing scene work, at least for me, I'm always trying to find a third thing in the scene, so that it becomes more complex, or a third and a fourth thing, and it can be in the form of somebody coming in and distracting, or what we already know about where the character has to go after this, and. I'm sort of, descending into gobbledygook here, but the point that I'm trying to make is that those themes still resonate in more sophisticated movies designed for older audiences. It's just that they tend to be more complex because our lives
right.
are complex, and our what we project onto them based on our life experience is more complex. So it becomes, you know, rather than checkers, it becomes chess in a way.
Sure. No, that's awesome. So how do you know, I mean, we were talking about ideas and things like this, but how do you know if you should write something? And I guess additionally for you as a director, if you want to direct something, but we were talking about ideas and you know, where they may come from, and maybe somebody gives you an idea or, you know, versus buying a script, you know, or optioning a script. How do you know if you should develop the project? What criteria do you use?
Well, I will plagiarize a line from our good friend Penn Densham by saying he had the best answer for this. He said, "I have to ask myself if it needs me." And I think that's, without being cute about it, it's actually a very thoughtful answer because the question needs to be broken down between sort of art and commerce, and sometimes they merge. We who do this have to make a living, and we don't always get to do what we want to do all the time. So we service other projects from time to time. Somebody gives you something, you need to make money, and you go, okay, I'm going to take that on, and I'm going to do the very best I can with that. And you're working for somebody else, and so you do the best you can in sort of an engineering and architectural way to serve their purpose, you know, their ideas. I'm working with Pietro Scalia right now on an adaptation of Lewis and Clark that he's going to direct, and it's a monstrously huge piece of history, you know, but it's his to direct. It's his story to tell. He is Italian. He has a different view of America than I do, and so in that case, I'm there to listen, learn, and try to infuse the characters with what's important to him, and that's fun, and it's satisfying on a certain level. In terms of and then sometimes you get offered ideas that studios or directors, producers want to develop into stories. Where they bring you a piece of existing material. And I will look at that, and I ask that same question. You know, is there something, can I bring something to this that isn't just, you know, the same as most everyone else is going to bring to it? And you can tell. I mean, especially if the piece of material doesn't really have a point of view, you're kind of reaching. And when I can afford to, I pass on those things. And as a director, too, it's so much of it is homogenized, so much of it is familiar. And unless the writer, you know, especially when you're given a script, unless the writer has a really cool voice, it looks like an awful lot of work for somebody like me to look at that piece of material and go, well, how the heck am I going to make that great? Especially when it's not flowing through my fingers, which is, you know, the place where I feel like I can really control the material. And then the third piece of it, I guess, would be, you know, what are the things that you as a writer or as a filmmaker are really passionate about? And, for instance, this film, The Last Full Measure, that we're working hard to get going this year, is I've stuck with it for so long, and it really goes back to a moment where I realized that I was part of that story by extension, and that was the moment. That was the aha moment when I knew that I had a place in that story. And I'll tell it to you anecdotally because I think it might be useful to people listening. I told you briefly what the story's about.
Uh-huh.
1966, young pararescueman goes to Vietnam, big time hero, drops into this horrible battle from a helicopter, refuses to go back up, saves about 60 guys' lives, and ultimately dies. And lo, 34 years later, this group of guys reassembles with the help of this other guy, and they go about the process of reinvestigating it and putting it before Congress. So that's the story. That's the story that I ended up telling. The story that the guy, so I was doing a movie for Wolfgang Petersen based on pararescue, the skill set pararescue, and it was based on a book.
Mm-hmm.
And the book was anecdotal, so I was struggling a little bit to try to figure out what that story was in peacetime, because this is back in 1999. And so I was going, one of the things that I should mention is that when you're, that I, one of my great joys, it goes back to a point we were talking about earlier, is this idea that we get to stick our toe in the water of all these wonderful different worlds. And
right.
one of them, in this case, was pararescue. And so I got to go through Indoc and quite a few of the schools that they go through over a 2 or 3 year period in order to become pararescuemen. And while I was there, while I was going through this, I was traveling all over the country, all these young guys would come up to me and say, yeah, it's cool that you're doing this movie. Do you know the story about Pitzenbarger? Do you know that one? And I'd politely say, yeah, kind of, but go ahead and tell me again. And they all wanted to tell me the story. This guy's like the patron saint of these guys. And I didn't want to really, I didn't want to make a movie about just a battle, you know. I didn't see myself doing that, but I kept listening. And I ended up at Kirtland Air Force Base, and coincidentally, Mr. Pitzenbarger was there. And they were dedicating a building in his son's name or something.
Wow.
And he got up, and he was very elderly. He was sick with cancer, and you realize, once I met him, I started to realize what the urgency was with these veterans, because they wanted this to happen before this guy passed away. And Mr. Pitzenbarger got up there and started talking, you know, in a very sort of homespun way about all of the things that he loved about his son, but most poignantly, the things he never got to see him do. Like, he never got to see him fall in love with a girl. He never got to see him get married, and he never got to see him have a son or a daughter of his own, because only then could he understand, his son understand, how much his father loved him.
Oh, wow.
And as I'm sitting there listening to this in the blazing sun in New Mexico, tears start rolling down my face. I mean, I don't mean to over-dramatize this, but I really found myself emotional.
Yeah.
And I flash back to the dinner table as a kid, and I wasn't. I'm a little too young to actually have gone to Vietnam, but I didn't miss it by much. And as we get older, you realize how fast time flies. I mean, hell, we've been in the desert for, you know, 13 years or whatever it is now.
Right.
So there we are sitting there. My parents are sitting there, and my dad's sitting over there, and we had a black and white Zenith TV. And the news comes on, and he'd always watch the news. And my dad was kind of a silence and rage guy, kind of guy, you know. He was great, but he didn't say a lot. And we're just sitting there, and he's eating his steak, and he looks up, and at the end of the news, they would flash up. This was McNamara's little game with America. They would flash up the KIAs and the wounded, and they'd
right.
show the Americans, you know, 12 killed in action, 24 wounded, and then they'd show the Vietnamese, and it would be 50 killed, 275 wounded, you know, and it was like a scorecard. And I would always kind of glance up as a 12-year-old or whatever I was and go, I guess we're winning, you know. It looked like
right.
a basketball game or something. And I just remember my dad looking up and muttering under his breath, "If this war lasts any longer, we're going to move to Canada."
Wow.
And I didn't know what that meant.
Right.
I had no understanding of what that meant until the moment that I was sitting there listening to Mr. Pitzenbarger, because at that moment in time, I had a young son. I still do have a young son. He's in college.
Uh-huh.
But so all of a sudden, there's three generations sitting there experiencing this multidimensionally, and I'm going, how would I feel if I lost my child in a war that he chose to go to because Pitzenbarger had volunteered to go?
Right.
How do you say to your kid, don't go and serve?
Right.
You know? Yeah, I mean, it's so complicated. And so it was in that moment that I knew that I had a story to tell, that where I had discovered myself in that conundrum. And so that was a very long story. Forgive me for burning everybody's ears out. But I use it to illustrate the point that if you think and are thoughtful and reflect, and there's something about it that's kind of hooked you anyway, you'll find that thing. And it just so happens that the themes in my work happen to often be about what I call non-romantic love stories between men. You know, fathers, sons, brothers, soldiers in arms, people on the field of sport, you know, those kind of things.
Uh-huh.
And so there it was. It was just laying there for me. And then the movie didn't become about the battle at all. It became about re-exploring the value of this man's sacrifice and why so many people cared about him. And they all happened to be men. And so the main character in the movie, it turns out, has a missing patriarch in his life. So it's really a story about how this young, very sort of disconnected, not too successful father in his own right, because he has a young son, is totally a political climber, and it's all about him. And he goes through the sort of emotional gristmill of how you become a man, and he does it through his interviewing of these men and the fact that they come to rely on him and put that pressure on him. And so it becomes a very, you know, wonderful he starts out not a nice guy, and you track him through the movie and you start to care about him through his wife, who was hung in there the whole time because she's the one who understands his potential as a human being. And so it starts off as a very simple nugget of an idea, and it becomes a very sophisticated exploration of the human condition. And so, you know, when I find something like that, I can't not do it. I can't not write it. I can't not, and that's why I've stuck with it for all these years. And
wow.
My actors have stuck with it. I mean, I have, you know, Morgan Freeman, Lawrence Fishburne, Andy Garcia, Ed Harris is going to do it. David Duchovny is going to work on it. I mean, it's all my guys are coming back because they love the piece of material. And that's, again, I said it before, I'll say it again, the coin of the realm is the realm of ideas, and that idea for us takes the form of the script. And if you have a great piece of material, they will come. And we as filmmakers have to make it impossible for people to say no to us, because it's so easy to. Because all the people that can say yes are generally, you know, afraid, because there's too much on the line for them. You know, there's great risk involved in making films. So, anyway.
No, that's awesome. I appreciate that so much. That was very well spoken, and I think for all of us who are listening, and truly, truly valuable and very beneficial. You know what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a break, and I'm going to come back, because there's so much that's in there, and I also want to tell the audience something. And give them a heads up for something. So if you'll excuse me for just a moment, we'll take that break and we'll come back. All right, Todd?
I'll be here.
Okay, cool. Everybody, you're listening to RexSykes.com. That's the official URL for Rex Sykes Movie Beat, or you're listening through RexSykes.com, I should say. All these interviews are stored there and archived there, and you can listen live from there. Please do share them with your friends, and please do leave a comment whenever you listen, wherever you listen, at the player or through the podcast. Do rate and review them. All right, you're listening to Mr. Todd Robinson, director of The Phantom. We're talking about writing and ideas and screenwriting and a whole host of stuff. Todd has so graciously consented to come back and talk about so many other things, and to do so, you know, in topics. And so just a heads up, you know, we're talking about writing and ideas and things now, but at some point there's financing and casting and actors and talent agents and lawyers and entourage and planning and scouting and budget and managing production and all sorts of things. So you're going to want to stay tuned to these discussions that we have upcoming with Todd, as well as this one. So please do share and let people know about it. I appreciate that. My next guest, and I'm just going to tell you about my next guest, is director Lance Cowis. And Lance is a director. He's done a number of independent films. He writes, and he's also been on the show before, and we're going to have him back on Thursday the 28th, and he's my next upcoming guest, so be sure to listen to the show with Lance. Peter Marshall will return because we're doing the director series in April, as well as many other guests. We resume on Serum in terms of shooting and stuff, and because of spring breaks and different schedules and meetings and things that I'm working on, the show will not necessarily happen every time it normally would, you know, but stay tuned to my website, stay tuned to Twitter, stay tuned to Rex Sykes Movie Beat on Facebook, and I'll let you know about upcoming guests as they come up, and then we'll get back on schedule at some point. So thanks for your support, thanks for listening, and thanks for being here today. We are back with Mr. Todd Robinson and his website. Oh, by the way, Julian Adams is coming up. He's going to be on the show, too, and he's works with Todd, is partners with Todd, produced Phantom with Penn and Todd. So we're going to have Julian up, and the website is solarfilmworks.com. And so you're going to want to check that out as well, solarfilmworks.com. In fact, I think Julian has joined us in the chat room, perhaps, so that's awesome. So I say hi to him if he's there. Okay, so we're back. So you know, this is really, really fascinating. Now, I know that, I can ask you where you find material, you know, where you get it, but instead I'm going to ask you this question, and that is because we were talking about ideas and how they come to you, how do you prepare to write? You know, like what's your process and the research and the preparation that you go through? You've now found something like what you just described. Where do you go from there?
Well, I think that writing begets writing. You can't, thinking and talking about things are not the same as writing them. And therefore, I find that something mysterious happens between the brain and the fingers on a keyboard through a pen or pencil, like Quentin Tarantino writes longhand, because that somehow for him triggers something, this mysterious sort of thing. To prepare to write, once I've gone through sort of all the machinations and decisions that we've just talked about, I need to prepare the road of discovery or the road for discovery. And the way that I do that is I begin to write, but I don't begin to write a screenplay. I begin to do what I call exercise work, and it starts with a very basic question, and I should tell you that I had early on in my career, I worked with a woman named Sally Merlin Jones, who taught at UCLA for many years, and really over her lifetime, she came from a family of writers, really was able to organize a series of questions in what she calls the writer's workbook that you can't find, so sorry folks, don't look for it, it's not published. But I would be happy to make it available to you, Rex, if you wanted to share it with the folks. But at any rate, it's a series of questions, and the first question is, why do I want to write? Or in my terms, why do I want to write this? And it's something that I begin to answer. Why do I want to write this? Well, I don't know, but I guess I want to write this because, and you just start writing. There are no rules. You say, well, I want to write this because there's this guy that I met, and he's interesting to me, and he kind of reminds me of my dad. And you know, when my dad was in the Navy, you know, and the next thing you know, you're writing about something that is actually personal. And I'll do 4 or 5 pages on that question and just write. And don't stop until you're finished. And you'll know when you're finished. But you can't cheat it. I try this with my students all the time at USC, and they always, you know, they come back with a half a page, and I go, uh-uh. That was you, you know, just trying to satisfy me. What you need to do is do something that will deliver you material. So the first question is, why do I want to write this? Other questions are, who is the story about? What does the main character want? Who is the adversary? And it's a long, long series of questions. It's a series of probably 15 questions like this that I address. But the biggest, maybe most important exercise is what I call biography work, which is me starting with the character, the main character. Usually I start I might start with their birth, but I usually go backwards, and because we're all formed by our families and our parents and so forth. So I will usually go back a generation and write a little bit about who that person's parents were and what their struggles might have been and so forth. And then I move through and I start writing this character biography that takes the guy or gal from birth to the beginning of the movie. And sometimes that'll be 20 pages long, single space. And I will do that for in varying degrees for all of the characters. I don't take that much time except for the main character, but I'll do that. And by the time I'm finished with this exercise work, I've discovered all kinds of things, and it's always personal, because how do you know what to write? Well, you can't know what to write because the character doesn't even exist. So how do you know who they are or what's happened to them or where they've been or how they're going to react to something? Well, if you write it down, if you start to write, you know, Bob Smith was born in Tallahassee, Florida in 1966. You know, if you start with that and start writing, and he had a sister. Well, what did his sister do? What was his sister about? Well, I don't know, but I have a sister. So invariably, you start writing anecdotally about your own life experience. And I track through all of this work. And in the old days, when before Sally passed away, she would print it out and take a highlighter, and would just start highlighting things through it. And when you looked at what was highlighted in various colors, you would start to realize that there were themes. There were things that you were hitting on. And when you looked at it in those terms, you went, oh, look, I'm writing about a son trying to win his father's approval. Huh, well, that's interesting. So now let's take Wall Street, for instance. Everybody's seen that movie. What is that movie about? Well, it's about Charlie Sheen, Bud, you know, trying to get out of the shadow of this blue-collar father that he has and be a real player. And in the end, he realizes that the most significant man he's ever known in his life is his dad, because he cares about other people before he cares about himself. Well, that just doesn't happen in a screenplay. That's a lot of work. And that's understanding what you write about. And that's finding a theme and that gives you point of view and philosophy and all of these things that will appear in the scenes. And if you're a writer-director and you've done this work, when the actors come to you and say, so I'm confused about what I'm supposed to be feeling here or what this little bit is about, you've got that information because you've already written it. And so if you do that kind of preparation, and sometimes it'll be 80, 100 pages for me, when I write Fade In, I'm not going to get stuck on page 50. You know, I'm just not, because I've so completely pre-vised it. It's like pre-visualization in writing. And I know a lot of people and a lot of writers groups that will tell you, oh, we can teach you how to write a screenplay in a month. Well, I can't do it. I work on these things for years sometimes. You know, it just keeps gestating and changing, and you put it down and you come back to it. And you know, I mean, if I have a job, I mean, a gig, I mean, I can probably soup to nuts write something in 4 months. But, you know, it may not really be ready for prime time. But that's me. I mean, David Mamet can sit down and grind it out. And I've heard tell that he doesn't do much rewriting. But he's David Mamet, and I'm not.
No, but that's, I think, you know, everybody will find their own zone at some point, or their own method, or their own what
process
works best for them, or a process that works best for them. Or they may struggle with finding that, you know, for much of their career or their lives. But you know, when you have something that works for you, whether somebody else has a slightly different process, the information about your process and or what you consider, whether it takes them, you know, a month or 4 months or 10 years, versus what it would take you, is still incredibly valuable information. The idea that you get to, you said in the beginning when we were talking that it's about who, and then you tell me that your process is sitting down and discovering that.
Right, and I agree. Everybody has a different process, and I would never like try to sell anybody specifically on what I do. But I do think that there is great benefit by doing that initial preparation.
Oh, right. No, I agree wholeheartedly.
You know, Sid Field used to say, and I didn't get this for a long time, but when I used to sit in his classes, he used to say, "If you don't know, who does?" And
right,
and it's a very profound question, because That's where people get stuck, and I understand it because I want to write, man. I want the results. I want the, you know, I probably said this before, but I love to quote Lillian Hellman, who says, "I hate to write, but I love to have written." You know,
I used to say is I don't want to work out. I want to have had worked out.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't want to get the body of Arnold Schwarzenegger. I want to already have had it.
Right.
Yeah.
And the only way to get there is the only way to go there is to get there. And the only way to get there is one foot in front of the other. So for most people, and you do get faster and faster at it. You know, like you're working on a television series. I mean, you got to grind something out in, 7 to 10 days. But it's a different form, and the characters are already, relatively created. I mean, they're growing, but, you don't have to start from zero. The reason I share that is because so many new people who come to this who are really passionate about writing and filmmaking, I see them fall apart halfway through and are completely stuck. And the reason that they're stuck is because they don't have the foundation that they need for their story. And so they're stuck. And then, especially if you're working with people who don't really understand writing per se, they start putting Band-Aids on it and asking the dreaded question, what if? You know, well, what if you did this and what if you did that? And, really it goes back to, well, what happened to him that would drive that decision or that piece of behavior? You know, and if you don't know, you don't know.
So this is cool. What's wrong with the what if? I mean, in other words, what are people they're grasping at when they get to that point?
Well, you said it, they're grasping. I mean, I don't mean to be too be cute about it or anything, but
no,
often,
it's
often a frustrating question, and the reason it's frustrating is because when somebody says, "Well, what if he did this?" You should already have the answer if you've done your homework. You know, or you'll know instantly if that is authentic to the character, to what that person might do. But a lot of times, especially in big story meetings where there are a lot of people around, a lot of ideas get thrown around, but they're not really in the tank with you, in the oubliette with you, in the bottom, in the dark, and so they tend to become superficial, and I'm not saying that good ideas don't come from that question, but it can be a little frustrating, even though it comes out of a good intention. But remember, people you're working with tend to be more less process oriented and more product oriented. They want a result, and this is why it's dangerous to discuss process with people you're working for, because it can confuse them and frighten them. So,
good point. Valid, very valid point. Well, I think also, and I think you probably already said it, so I may just be repeating it in a way. But I mean, once you get to the what if stage, and you're just throwing out possibilities as if find the right path to take. If that's where you are, I mean, it says that. To me, I mean, if I'm going, well, what if I take this, or what if I do this, or what if I do this, or I don't know where I am. I mean, I completely at a point where it's like spaghetti against the wall, and I'm just trying to throw things to get something that somehow makes sense. And what I hear you say is, if you understand your character and you understand the person and you understand their motivations and their needs from their history and everything else, then the what ifs are incidental to. I mean, well, something could happen in life that came along, and the character, you would know how the character would respond or not respond.
Yeah, and by the way, confusion is an absolute normal state of being in any kind of creative process. How do you know what you're going to write next? I don't know. you just write. Or how do you know where to put the camera? It's a great question. But if you do the homework, if you do the preparation, if you prepare the scene to be photographed, if you come with all the information that your actors and your crew and everybody needs, then you're good to go. And you really, there's really not much more that you can do. But in the writing process is so solitary that I just thought it bore mentioning that you need to first to review, you know, find that kernel of the thing that touches you so that you have a really good reason to write it. And then if it's a wholly fictional story or character, you can only write about what you know. And what do you know best? You know you. So when you go through and do this exploratory writing, you're going to come up with things that are, A, original, because they happened to you. They didn't happen to anybody else. Off you go. I'll give you a quick example. I did a movie, and it's sort of a tragedy because it didn't end up in the movie, but I did a movie a few years ago called Lonely Hearts with John Travolta and Gandolfini. And, it's a story about a cop. It's based on a true story, a true crime story, and John Travolta is a detective. But he's lost his wife to a suicide, and he and his young son, who's about, I don't know, 14, 15, are processing this tragedy in their life, and he has taken all of his pain and this sort of existential angst and put it on this one case because it's a pretty heinous case. And so that becomes the thing whereby he's trying to find redemption for personal culpability in his wife's suicide. And in the scene, or in the movie, there was a scene where the boy, his son, they have a fight, and the boy runs out, jumps on his bike, and his dog follows him out, you know, chases him outside. And you hear a tire screech, and he runs outside. You hear the bike go down, and you run outside, and you think that the boy's been hit by the car, but it's really the dog. And the dog is dead, and the kid comes unglued. And Travolta takes him up to his bedroom, and he's talking to him, it wasn't your fault, blah, 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 blah. And they're having this conversation, this very emotional conversation, and what you realize is the kid isn't talking about the dog. The kid's talking about his mother. You know, why wasn't I there? How could I let this happen? Blah, 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 blah. And so the dog being hit by the car became the emotional trigger. And the way I discovered that was because when I was a kid, my dog got hit by a car, and my grandmother had died. And I never cried when my grandmother died. I sucked it up. And when the dog died, I cried for that dog for a month. I couldn't let it go. That the grief was so deep. And really, as an adult, looking back, I realized that that was really as much about my grandmother as it was about my dog. And so that's something that I don't think I could have just cooked up. It's something that I found in that preparatory writing. And it ended up being really the cornerstone of the movie. And unfortunately, the folks that made the movie chose to not put that scene in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Funny to me. Actually, they didn't let me complete shooting it.
Well, that sucks. Well, you know, and this is a conversation for later. Let's remember this, you know, the difference between the final cut and not final cut and you know, how people can impinge on, on your own project.
Sure. Well, you know, we are always working for other people. So
right. So we save that for one of our other conversations. It's important, you know, to note, you know, and this is fascinating for me. And one of the things that when I was a kid, and I used to like to write, and I wanted to write detective stuff, and I still I read a very narrow range of detective books still to this day, or crime thrillers or whatever. I like certain authors, and I tend to read their series. But as a reader, I went, oh my God, I could never do this. I mean, I could never do this. I don't understand how Michael Connelly has, you know, so many books in a year, or how John Sanford has, you know, so many books in a year, unless they've got writers, you know, writing for them, kind of, you know. But like the romance novel stuff, where, you know, one name and 100 different people writing books. But what truly blows my mind is that I used to think, well, I was just a good writer, and now I'm more insecure than ever because I read these complicated, twisted plots with, you know, technical background stuff and information that, you know, unless I were working in it or had, you know, researchers working on it 24 hours, I would never know to do that. I mean, my detective case would be somebody did it, how did they do it, and now it's done. You know, I mean, that's just very simple. The research side to some of these things, like you, when you were on a submarine, you know, doing a submarine or you know, the case of your upcoming movie. I mean, just how do you do the research? How do you, you know, do you pore over it yourself? Are you able to hire, like, I mean, some people have, you know, their own research assistants and things like that, but how do you research for what you want to do?
Well, first of all, I would just agree with you that the sort of CSI-ization of detective stories has kind of killed the shoe leather aspect of of crime stories. I mean, it really has. I mean, when it comes down to a swab of DNA or, you know, a smudge of this or a smudge of that, it has made it very difficult to go back to more traditional stories of investigation.
Like Raymond Chandler, I could maybe write something not anywhere near as classy as Raymond Chandler, but I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, you know,
you'd have to place it in a part of history where these more modern shortcuts didn't exist, because again, it's about who, right? Like I don't care if it's about a microscope. I care about the fact that this guy's outthinking the criminal or whatever based on. I mean, look at Chinatown. I mean, you know, that entire character is driven by something that happened in his past that you don't really ever even understand. And what is it about? Well, it's about the big water scandal. But who is it about? It's about a tragically flawed man, you know, who could never get out of the way of his own ego. And, you know, because he thought, whatever. You see what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
So, to get to your question, research is key. I don't have research assistants. It doesn't seem like to be a lot of fun in that. I've gotten to do some pretty crazy things over the years. In the case of Phantom, I had a wonderful technical advisor named Kenneth Sewell, who really helped on that movie in ways that can't even be measured. But I can tell you that by the time we were shooting that movie, he was the only guy that knew the submarine better than me. I pretty much knew where everything was, what everything did. I mean, I there's so much to a submarine, but I pretty much knew where the systems were. And so if an actor asked me something, I could give them a pretty good approximation, especially in terms of operating the bow planes and the rudders and those sort of things.
Wow.
And the valves and torpedo launching and all those kind of things. But it was because I spent a lot of time with Ken walking through multiple submarines, learning that. Because on the day when you're shooting, you need to have some authority about these things.
Sure.
The actors kind of shrug and go, well, who should we talk to, you know? And occasionally I would call upon him, but by the time in that movie we got going, I knew it pretty well. And I certainly knew the nomenclature and the verbiage that was used. I mean, all of that is absolutely authentic in that movie. But I'll give you another kind of a fun thing that I got to do. I wrote a movie that never got made called Descent, and it was about an effort to this is about 12 or 15 years ago now, but it was an effort to do the deepest submerged underwater cave penetration in the world in the Yucatan Peninsula.
Wow.
And in those days, before we had practical rebreathers, they were just coming online, but they were huge. They were like the backpack on an Apollo mission or something,
uh-huh.
A spacewalk mission. And now they're very, very small and compact. But what it meant was they called it the Everest of the underground, where these underground unexplored rivers in karst formations extended for many, 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 many miles. And in order to get, they were really trying to get all the way through this one cave system. And in order to do that, you had to Sherpa in tanks of compressed air, hundreds and hundreds of tanks. And the amount of tanks it took to support the last half a mile push, it was like this huge pyramid of air tanks, you know. And so most of the effort was just setting it up so that you could make that last little extra push. Very unforgiving environment. A lot of people have died over the years doing it. And I got to go dive and get certified.
Wow.
Insurance guy. But I got to be certified as a cave diver, which is not that remarkable, except it was for me. There are a lot of people who have that certification, but going into a cave, you know,
sure.
a couple of hundred yards back and understanding how to save your butt if your gear goes bad and,
right.
and that you're really, you are honest to God. How long does it take to die if you fall out of an airplane? Well, I don't know. Your parachute doesn't open. You got maybe a minute, two, whatever,
right.
in a cave. You know, you get lost. You could have 20 minutes, an hour to think about the fact that you're not going home.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So it was crazy. And so for me to be able to go in and dive with Wes Skiles and Bill Stone and these guys deep into these caves and have that real anxiety for myself where, like, all of a sudden you get paranoid and you're, like, going, what if this guy decides to rip the regulator out of my mouth? Yeah. And I remember going in one room, and it was this beautiful room with stalactites and stalagmites, this incredible room. And I'm looking around, and I became completely drunk with the beauty of it.
Oh, wow.
And because
yeah.
the scariest thing is it's not always scary. And I'm looking around, and Wes scribbles something on his whiteboard and holds it up to me, and it says, "Which way out?"
Oh, God.
And I looked around, and I realized there were three or four tunnels that had led into the room.
Oh,
and I
Lord.
Didn't know which one we had come in. So that's research.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, how could I have ever made that up? I mean, if you've never been in an underwater cave, like, how do you even know? You think of it like a sewer pipe or something, you know? So those are the things that give you a sense of command over your subject. And when you're writing, you really want the reader to go, because I read lots and lots of scripts, and most of it is, you know, 50 on the 100 scale, you know, and when I read something where I realize that, God, this guy really is an astronaut, or this guy really is a, you know, that's when you really start digging it. And so you have to, you know, beyond your interest in the emotional side of it, which you're going to work out through your process, you also have to be in complete command of the subject. And the only way that you can do that is through research. I guess I could have just said that in a sentence, but I...
no, but it, no, but no, 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 no. The story that you told, I think, far better illustrates it. Because if I were to approach, you know, cave diving without ever having done it, and I read every book on it, or if I went off the top of my head, you know, I would have people going down, like you said, like, you know, just down a sewer pipe. I'd have them go into a cave. And I would think, okay, probably, maybe if I really thought about it, I would think, okay, maybe there are multiple feeds into the cave, you know, and some go out and some don't or whatever. But you know, I wouldn't come to the same level of detail or experience or feeling, especially feeling, because for you to discover in a moment inside a cave, I don't know which way is out. That experience, I can't make that up.
Yeah, and you also can't make up the sense of trust that you have to have, because this was all pre-planned for my own,
uh-huh.
you know, for my education, right?
Right.
Because I did what so many of these guys, they basically wrote the book on the safety manual in terms of getting certified, because they lost a lot of friends through trial and error doing this. And, of course, today there's very sophisticated, you know, use of cartography and you know, bringing a line in with you. And, you know, there are little plastic arrows on the line so you know which way's in, which way's out, all kinds of things. But what he was doing was giving me that experience. And it was interesting because I completely succumb to panic. And they say that they used to say this thing like the dragon is in the cave somewhere for everybody. It just depends how deep. In other
right.
words,
right.
and these
right.
guys do the crazy stuff where they would pull off their gear and pull it through little tight squeezes and you know really really claustrophobic stuff.
Oh, Lord.
And but I had this moment where I had this moment of panic, and anybody can call a dive. And I just finally I looked at Wes and I said, you know what, I need to go out. Now, and it was just what you were saying before. I didn't want to go out. I wanted to be out.
Yeah,
the only
right.
way to be out was to go out. And I was kind of having anxiety, you know, and it was flipping me out. I wasn't happy for a minute there. And Wes said, okay, it's cool, it's cool. He just take my arm, and I put my hand on his arm, and we start swimming out. There were like five or six guys on the dive. And we start going through, and you start imagining in your mind, now I'm in this little almond-shaped tunnel, and you start to think, well, there's, you know, 30 feet of rock above me, and there's 3 football fields of water ahead of me, and it's not just tubes. It's going through big shale, freaking, you know, outcroppings and all kinds of stuff. And I started, you know, you start thinking about that, and it's not good. You know, you're not having a good time. And so what Wes did was something which was fascinating. He turned his flashlight. He made us turn our lights off.
Uh-huh.
And we had the string, right? It's more than a string. It's a line that you run your finger through so you know where you're going. And the most amazing thing happened when he turned off the light. I was no longer in a little tube. I was in the great void of black, a great void of blackness.
Mm-hmm.
And in that void of blackness, there was no sense of claustrophobia.
Oh, very
now,
cool.
That's great shit to write about, you know. And again, like I couldn't have ever cooked that up.
You could never have imagined it. No, and I'm a huge person in my life about contingency planning when I teach programs and stuff, you know, or pre-production and stuff. But you know, you have to travel in advance of the world in order to know where you've been and what you encounter to come back to be able to solve it quickly. Now, what you've just described, to me, I go, now these guys have got to be brilliant, because first off, you know, if you went down into a cave and you said, okay, what are all the possible things that you could think of that would, you know, freak somebody out when they're in a cave? Well, you might say claustrophobia or all that. But the one thing that I hadn't thought of until you mentioned it, too, is the immense beauty that you could get caught up in just how incredible something is and lose your bearing or lose your sense of time, you know, and that could present, you know, a life challenge. And that the people who are, you know, taking you down may go, well, we could always take you down to the tiniest cave, or we could take you to the most beautiful cave, or we could, you know what I mean? In other words, for understanding the propensity for people to do things, I guess is what I'm getting at. I like to think that I know how I will encounter every situation in my life. Somebody described something the other day. He went skydiving, I went skydiving. And he said, you know, all the pants, and I don't remember even if this was a show that I was talking with or whatever, and it may have been my recent guest, but talking about skydiving, and he said, you know, all of us, we were in this little Cessna, and you climb out on the strut, and you let go, and he said all the panic gave way to this incredible silence and awe and, you know, everything, and you're up there. And I was like, wow, me too. I remember when I went skydiving, how nervous I was before I let go, and once I let go, the experience was completely transformed. One, I would never have thought I was nervous if I had thought about skydiving that way. This is a piece of cake, no big deal, I'm a brave guy, I can do that. But I was scared. And then two, once I let go and I was sure that my chute was open, kind of thing, I was like, this is the most incredible experience I've ever had. I mean, I'm looking over, and he articulated this, and I went, yeah, me too. Now, I couldn't have written that without having done it, but even more to the point, I'm a dad. And you're a dad, you know, but I could never have written about children until I had children. I would have thought that I could write these kids. I could do it. I don't know that I can write them now, being a dad. I'm just saying that my whole entire life experience has changed in relationship to having children that I would never have ever understood had I not had children. And yet I would have sworn up and down that my cat was the equal to anybody's child, or that my dog had been, that because I was a pet owner, I knew what it was like to be a parent.
Look, there is an element of make-believe that we have to do because we can't be in command of everything. However, you're right. I'll flip that on its head. I did a movie years ago called The Four Diamonds with Christine Lottie and some other great folks, and it was a story about, actually a true story about a friend of mine's brother who had died of a childhood cancer.
Uh-huh.
And it's a beautiful story that's told in a fantasy world where his real life, the people in his real life are reflected in a Wizard of Oz-like fantasy that he wrote as a school project in lieu of what I did last summer, which was chemo. And it's a beautiful story. And the Four Diamonds Fund, I'll just give them a plug, is run by the Penn State University, and they have a dance marathon every year and raise millions and millions of dollars for various children's cancer hospitals and things. But that, there's a story that I wrote before I had kids, and today I don't think I could write it because
it's
just too painful.
Because
it's almost as if I had to write that one before I had the kids. Now, I had the family, right, to tell me, to give me all the information about that child. So, you know, I was able to do the best that I could. And I also had this piece of literary material that he had written to adapt. And so it wasn't like I was starting from scratch, I'm going to write a story about children. But anyway, it's interesting because sometimes your life takes a turn and you go, you know, that's a subject I probably don't want to cover anymore.
True. That's a good point. And I got to agree with you. I don't mean that you can't write things that you don't have experience with, but that once you have experience with, you have an understanding of it or an appreciation of it that changes everything about your approach to it. In other words, you have more nuance, because of the diving. I mean, I may find the same thing, which you just said. Something could be very tough to write now, but I'm in full agreement with you. I just think you write about what you know, and if you don't know it, you have to go elsewhere to get it. You know, and you can.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring that up because I was recently working on a project and I was doing it with another writer. And there's the main character is a teenage girl. And I have one of those, and he doesn't. And he was trying to, try to explain to me the logic of a 17-year-old girl. And I'm here to tell you, when I figure it out, I'll let you know.
There you go.
But it's interesting, you know, the behavior and the sort of the mood swings and all of those things that, you know, again, like I'm sitting in my, I'm a stranger in my own house sometimes, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, trying to sort those things out. And so there really is something quite wonderful about the befuddlement of things sometimes, too, where, you know, you're bearing witness to something you can't quite explain or untangle.
It is amazing. Now, we have, let me see here, we have just a few minutes left. How many minutes do we have? Where is our clock on the studio wall? We've got, probably about, 7 minutes left, 8 minutes left, something like that. And, you know, we were talking about writing, and there's lots of stuff that, we can come back and talk the next time. And you and I have got to arrange some kind of schedule that works for you that, you know, when you can come back. But, I want to get into, more about the writing, and then once you have the script, then what? But how much does the market dictate what you choose, and has that changed? I mean, or do you ever go, I have this story, you know, and in order to sell the story, it has to be written somewhat differently than how I might write it if I were just writing it for myself. Are those considerations that you ever make?
It's interesting. It's really interesting question, and I'm a student. You know, I'm continuing to learn. I'm continuing to learn the business and all of the things that you need to know to just make a living, let alone make a successful movie. There's a young guy in my life named David Ellison who your listeners will probably know finances quite a few of Paramount's movies. And he's really, really smart, and it's sort of astonishing how quickly he was able to embrace, understand, and then be able to explain to you the way that the business works at that level. The movies that moved me when I was in college, for instance, or after college, was a movie like, say, Ordinary People. That to me was like a perfect movie because I had come from an acting background. I mean, that movie held everything for me. And those kind of movies today, and so those are the kind of movies that I set out to make early on. And those movies are not really being made easily today. In the fall, you know, you get to see all the Weinstein movies and so forth that have been, cherry-picked and make it to the top. But in terms of getting those movies distributed and marketed properly, and it's very, very difficult. And I think part of this has to do with the fact that there is a much more sort of a corporate philosophy about product. It's really viewed as product. And so so the further I get down the road, the more I realize that that I really am providing a product for a big machine that needs to put product out in the marketplace. I mean, they need to put paper towels on the shelf, you know. And so I can't, if they want paper towels, I can't give them toilet paper. So it really is part of, my business to understand what people need and what the audience wants. And I used to be a little bit more, stuffy about it. Like, I wanted to write what I wanted to write, and I wanted to do what I wanted to do. And I think there was more latitude back in the day. But now, as we move down the line, and I get a sense that, look, I'm always going to be able to find something in it for me. And just because I'm trying to write a commercial movie for somebody doesn't mean that there isn't something good in it. I mean, look at all the movies that are out. I mean, it was such a great fall. There were so many great movies, all year. I mean, look at Batman, Chris Nolan. I mean, look at his films, completely and utterly commercial, and they couldn't be more just brilliant, and creative, and, Inception. I mean, look at that movie. I mean,
right.
People attack movies and pick things apart, but you look at the imagination that went into that movie, and that guy made that work so you could understand it. Let me tell you, that is big, big stuff. And so, I look to that and go, well, that's what I aspire to, in my own way. So when you look at it, JJ, and you look at Ridley, and you look at, the men that can really mount big pictures, those are the kind of, that's the world that I want to serve. But not so much the filler.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Cutting myself off.
Well, in the maybe 2 or 3 minutes, I would say, I think of it sometimes this way. I think, if I were manufacturing shoes, I would probably be best served by finding out the kind of shoes people want or need, and trying to manufacture something along those lines that still is aesthetically pleasing or that has some creative component in it for me or something in it for me, than to simply go, I've made some shoes, who wants them? Now, both approaches are valid. One seems to be a little bit easier since it's a marketing world, but one seems to be a little bit easier.
Let me just jump in and say that I didn't mean to say that you shouldn't make what you're passionate about.
I didn't take it that way at all.
What one needs to do, and Phantom is an excellent example of this, is you need to manage your expectations, and you have to manage the production. So Phantom is a movie that we set out, Julian and I set out initially, and then with John and Penn, to make basically a micro movie. This is a movie that had a budget of $3 million, a very, very small movie. That we wanted to experiment with and, blend with CGI and practical models and all those kind of things, and a very real submarine rooted in a good piece of material that would attract those kind of actors, and see if we couldn't make a movie that looked like a big movie for no money, And it was completely and utterly satisfying and successful on that level. Now, the fact that, the business went out and tried to, put it out there as like a studio movie, I have no control over that. But the experience of doing it was, utterly satisfying and for us, completely successful, because that's what we set out to do. So if you have something that you're passionate about with digital technology and Final Cut Pro on your laptop, for crying out loud, go make your movie.
Oh, I agree. I agree.
So.
No, I think that's well put. I guess my point is simply that I encounter a lot of people who go, damn everyone, I don't give a crap, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And I go, that's fine. I mean, you do it, be true to yourself, but at the same time realize that that there is still a business side to things, and you might want to do some research before you do your movie, you know, or do your movie and see if you can sell it. You might, you may not, but at least you will have done your project.
Well,
so,
I think we're coming back to the same point. We have to respect the fact that there is tremendous investment and risk in making movies on any level. And if you're going to work within the conventional systems, you're working for people. You're there to deliver a service to them, and you have to honor and respect that. And so it's a choice that you make. And by the way, you know, one for them, two for you, or two for them and one for you. I mean, there are lots of ways to remain artistically satisfied and still make a living. And by the way, you know, like, wouldn't it be great to make a great big huge movie? Come on.
Yeah.
It doesn't get any better than that, you know.
Yeah, no, so. Good point. Todd, you know, we're at that point where we're literally out of time, but I want to come back, you know, and we'll let the listeners know when that's going to be, and you and I can schedule, and we'll take care of that, but I really want to come back. You know, we're kind of in that nuts and bolts from soup to nuts thing where, you know, we're getting a project. Now, we'll come back and go, okay, so once you have the script, then what? You know, and we can discuss other things, we can continue. And if listeners have questions that they want to email or get us in the chat room has been persnickety today, and people have been having trouble getting in to, you know, to ask questions. But, you know, we'll come back and we'll talk more at length the next time. But I have so enjoyed this. This is fantastic. I'm going to give you a call right back after the show is over. But I appreciate this so much. This is awesome.
My pleasure.
Well, thank you. I'll talk to you in just a few minutes, and then we'll come back. And it's solarfilmworks.com, and that's your website with Julian Adams. And we'll talk more about that in just a second. But thank you, sir.
Okay, thanks, Rex. See you next time.
All right, I'll talk to you in a moment. Bye-bye. Mr. Todd Robinson, director of Phantom and Lonely Hearts and others. And, you know, as I said, we'll have him come back. My next guest is going to be Lance Cowis, and we're going to have Julian Adams come on to the show, who is also a producer of Phantom. He's also an actor. He's got other projects as well. And two incredibly great guys. And Penn Densham, a favorite as well. Hopefully we can have Penn back sometime soon, too. But these three guys are in the trenches, and they're making it happen, and they're doing stuff. And I'm so grateful and so glad that we get to share their expertise with you. So Lance Cowis is up next on the 28th of whatever this month is, March. So be sure to tune in, and then we'll let you know who and when and how all these guests are coming up through Facebook, Rex Sykes Movie Beat Friends on Facebook, Rex Sykes Movie Beat Friends on Facebook, follow there, or through my website, Rex Sykes Movie Beat at RexSykes.com. There's a list of people as they come up, and as well on Twitter, so stay tuned and keep helping me share the show and keep leaving comments when you're in the chat room. Leave comments there at the player, rate and review the show. I appreciate it. I want to thank my fascinating guest, Mr. Todd Robinson, for being with us today, and for you, the readers and listeners of Movie Beat. Again, many more exciting guests coming up, so be sure to stay tuned and keep sharing. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at Rex Sykes Movie BT. That's Rex Sykes Movie BT on Twitter. Also have a YouTube channel, Rex Sykes Movie Beat, that's available there. And I think that's pretty much it, but I really appreciate all your love and your support and all the questions, and for joining us in the chat room, for all the stuff that you do to make Movie Beat available to your friends and your connections, and, you know, make your movies. That's the cool. Make your web series, your TV shows, your pilots, your shorts, whatever you may be doing, and enjoy the process. Everybody, have a fabulous day. Make your movies, complete your projects, and until we meet the next time, that is that.